organized crime? Madeline asked. Harriet exhaled loudly in a mixture of wonder and irritation. The point is, fairy godparents don't go on family trees. First, because they're not blood. Second, because they're secretive people. They have to be, because otherwise everyone would be hitting them up for cash. But keeping secrets is wrong. Not always. Do you keep secrets? No, Harriet lied. Do you think my mom does? No, Harriet said, but now she meant it. How she wished Elizabeth would keep a few secrets, or at least opinions to herself. Now, let's fill in this tree with a bunch of hodgepodge. Your teacher will never know the difference, and then we can watch your mom's show.
You want me to lie?
Mad, Harriet said, irritated. Did I say lie? Do fairies not have blood? Of course fairies have blood, Harriet shrieked. She rested a hand on her forehead. Let's put this on hold for now. Go play outside. But go throw the ball for 6:30. I have to bring a photograph, too, Harriet, Madeline added. Something with the whole family? From under the table, 6:30 rested his head on her bony knee. The whole family, Madeline emphasized. That means it has to have my dad in it, too. No, it doesn't. 6:30 stood up and made his way to Elizabeth's bedroom. If you don't want to throw the ball for 6:30, then take 6:30 and go to the library. Your books are overdue. You have just enough time before your mom's show.
I don't feel like it.
Well, sometimes we have to do things we don't feel like doing.
What do you do that you don't feel like doing?
Harriet closed her eyes. She pictured Mr. Sloane. Chapter 28 Saints. Madeline, the city librarian said, what can I help you with today?
I need to find an address for a place in Iowa.
Follow me. The librarian led Madeline through the warren of the library, pausing briefly to chastise a reader for turning down the corners of pages to mark places and another for propping his legs up on an adjacent chair.
This is the Carnegie Library, she whispered angrily. I can bar you for life.
Up here, Madeline, she said, leading her to a shelf of phone books. You said Iowa, correct? She reached up and pulled down three thick volumes. Any town in particular?
I'm looking for a boy's home, Madeline said, but with a girl's name, that's all I know.
We'll need more information than that, the librarian said. Iowa isn't small. I'd put my money on Sioux City, came a voice from behind.
Sue isn't a girl's name, the librarian said, turning. It's an Indian name. Oh, Reverend, hello. I'm so sorry. I forgot to find that book you wanted. I'll do it now.
But it could be mistaken as a girl's name, couldn't it? The man in the dark robes continued. Sue versus Sue? A child might make that mistake.
Well, not this child, the librarian said.
It's not here, Madeline said 15 minutes later as her finger trailed down the B column. No boys' home.
Oh,
the Reverend said from across the library table. I should have mentioned. Sometimes those places are named after saints.
Why?
Because people who take care of other people's children are saints.
Why?
Because taking care of children is hard. Madeline rolled her eyes. Try St. Vincent, he said, running his finger just beneath his clerical collar to let some air in.
What are you reading? Madeline asked as she flipped to the S in the phone book.
Religious things, he said. I'm a minister.
No, I meant the other thing, that thing, she said, pointing to a magazine he'd tucked between the pages of scripture.
Oh, he said, embarrassed. That's just for fun.
Mad magazine, she read aloud as she yanked it out of hiding.
It's humor, the Reverend explained quickly, taking it back. Can I see it? I don't think your mother would approve.
Because there are naked pictures?
No, he said. No, it's nothing like that. It's just that sometimes I need a laugh. There is not much humor in my job.
Why?
The Reverend hesitated. Because God isn't very funny, I guess. Why are you searching for a boy's home?
It's where my dad grew up. I'm doing a family tree.
I see, he said, smiling. Well, a family tree sounds like a lot of fun.
That's debatable.
Debatable?
It means arguable, Mad said.
So it does, he said, surprised. Do you mind me asking, how old are you?
I'm not allowed to give out private information.
Oh,
he said, red-faced. Of course not. Good for you. Madeline chewed on the end of her eraser. Anyway, he said, it's fun to learn about one's ancestors, isn't it? I think so. What have you got so far? Well, Mad said, swinging her legs under the table. On my mom's side, her dad is in jail for burning some people up, her mom is in Brazil because of taxes, and her brother is dead. Oh. I don't have anything on my dad's side yet, but I'm thinking the people at the boys' home are sort of like family. In what way? Because they took care of him. The Reverend rubbed the back of his neck. In his experience, these homes were staffed with pedophiles. Saints, you called them, she reminded him. He sighed inwardly. The problem with being a minister was how many times a day he had to lie. This was because people needed constant reassurance that things were okay or were going to be okay, instead of the more obvious reality that things were bad and were only going to get worse. He'd been officiating a funeral just last week. One of his congregants had died of lung cancer, and his message to the family, all of whom also smoked like chimneys, was that the man had died not because of his four-pack-a-day habit, but because God needed him. The family, each inhaling deeply, thanked him for his wisdom. But why write to the boys' home? He asked. Why not just ask your dad? Because he's dead too, she sighed. Good Lord, the Reverend said, shaking his head. I'm very sorry. Thank you, Madeline said in a serious way. Some people think you can't miss what you never had, but I think you can. Do you? Absolutely, he said, touching the back of his neck until he located the small chunk of hair that was slightly too long. When he went to visit a friend in Liverpool, they'd gone to see a brand new musical group called the Beatles. They were British and they had bangs. It was nearly unheard of for men to have bangs, but he found he liked their look almost as much as he liked their music. What are you looking for in there? She asked him, pointing to his book. Inspiration, he said. Something to move the spirit for Sunday's sermon. What about fairy godmothers? She asked. My dad's home had a fairy godmother. She gave the home money. Oh, he said. I think you mean a donor. The home may have had several. It takes a lot of money to run those places. No, she said. I mean a fairy godmother. I think you have to be a bit magical to give money to people you don't even know. The Reverend felt another jolt of surprise. True, he admitted. But Harriet says earning a paycheck is better. She doesn't like magic. Who's Harriet? My neighbor. She's Catholic. She can't get divorced. Harriet thinks I should fill the family tree with hodgepodge, but I don't want to. It makes me feel like there's something wrong with my family. Well, the Reverend said carefully, thinking it did very much sound like there was something wrong with a child's family, Harriet probably only means some things are private. You mean secret? No, I mean private. For instance, I asked you how old you were, and you correctly answered that it was private information. It's not secret, it's just that you don't know me well enough to tell me. But a secret is something we keep because there's a chance that if someone knew our secret, they would use it against us or make us feel bad. Secrets usually involve things we're ashamed of. Do you keep secrets? Yes, he admitted. How about you? Me too, she said. I'm pretty sure everyone does, he said, especially the people who say they don't. There's no way you go through life without being embarrassed or ashamed about something. Madeline nodded. Anyway, people think they know more about themselves based on these silly branches full of names of people they'd never met. For instance, I know someone who's very proud to be a direct descendant of Galileo and another who can trace her roots back to the Mayflower. They both talk about their lineage as if they have a pedigree, but they don't. Your relatives can't make you important or smart. They can't make you you. What makes me me, then? What you choose to do. How you live your life. But lots of people don't get to choose how they get to live, like slaves. Well, the Reverend said, chagrined by her simple wisdom, that's true too. They sat quietly for a few moments, Madeline skimming her finger down the phone book pages, the Reverend considering the purchase of a guitar. Anyway, he added, I think family trees aren't a very intelligent way to understand one's roots. Madeline looked up at him. A minute ago, you said it would be fun to learn about my ancestors. Yes, he confessed, but I was lying, which made both of them laugh.
From across the way, the librarian raised her head in warning. "I'm Reverend Wakely," he whispered, nodding an apology to the frowning librarian, "from First Presbyterian." "Mad Zot," Madeline said. "Mad, like your magazine." "Well, Mad," he said carefully, thinking Mad must be French for something. "If it's not under St. Vincent, try St. Elmo, or wait, try All Saints. That's what they call places when they can't decide on a single saint." "All Saints," she said, flipping to the A's. All. "Wait, here it is, All Saints Boys Home." But her excitement was short-lived. "But there's no address, just a phone number." "Is that a problem?" "My mom says you only call long distance if someone dies." "Well, maybe I could call for you from my office. I have to call long distance all the time. I could say I was helping a member of my congregation." "You'd be lying again. Do you do that a lot?" "It would be a white lie, Mad," he said, slightly irritated. Would no one ever understand the contradictions of his job? "Or," he said more pointedly, "you could follow Harriet's advice and fill the tree with hodgepodge, which isn't such a bad idea, because quite often the past belongs only in the past." "Why?" "Because the past is the only place it makes sense." "But my dad isn't in the past. He's still my dad." "Of course he is," the Reverend said, softening. "I just meant in terms of me calling All Saints, that they might feel more comfortable talking with me because we're both in religion, like you probably feel more comfortable talking to the kids at school about school things." Madeline looked surprised. She'd never once felt comfortable talking to the kids at school. "Or I know," he said, now wanting to extricate himself from the whole thing. "Ask your mother to call. It's her husband. I'm sure they'd help. They might need proof of the marriage before they'd be willing to give her anything significant, a certificate, something like that, but that should be easy enough." Madeline froze. "On second thought," Madeline said, quickly writing two words on a scrap of paper, "here's my dad's name." Then she added her phone number and handed it to him. "How soon can you call?" The minister glanced down at the name. "Calvin Evans," he said, drawing back in surprise. Back when he'd been at Harvard Divinity School, Wakely audited a chemistry course. His goal? To learn how the enemy camp explained creation so he could refute it. But after a year of chemistry, he found himself in deep water, thanks to his newly acquired understanding of atoms, matter, elements, and molecules. He now struggled to believe God had created anything, not heaven, not earth, not even pizza. As a fifth-generation minister attending one of the most prestigious divinity schools in the world, this was a huge problem. It wasn't just the familial expectations, it was also science itself. Science insisted on something he rarely encountered in his future line of work, evidence. And in the middle of this evidence was a young man. His name was Calvin Evans. Evans had come to Harvard to sit on a panel made up of RNA researchers, and Wakely, having nothing better to do on a Saturday night, attended. Evans, who was by far the youngest on the panel, barely said anything. There was a lot of shop talk from the others about how chemical bonds were formed, broken, then reformed, following something called an effective collision. Frankly, the whole thing was a little boring. Still, one of the panelists continued to drone on about how real change only ever arose through the application of kinetic energy. That's when someone in the audience asked for an example of an ineffective collision, something that lacked energy and never changed, but still had a big effect. Evans had leaned into his microphone. "Religion," he said. Then he got up and left. The religion comment edited him, so he decided to write to Evans and say so. Much to his surprise, Evans wrote back. And then he wrote back to Evans, and then Evans wrote back to him, and so on. Even though they disagreed, it was clear they liked each other, which is why, once they'd cleared the hurdles of religion and science, their letters turned personal. It was then they discovered that they were not only the same age, but shared two things in common. An almost fanatical love for water-based sports, Calvin was a rower, he was a surfer, and an obsession for sunny weather. In addition, neither had a girlfriend, neither enjoyed graduate school, neither was sure what life held after graduation. But then Wakeley had ruined the whole thing by mentioning something about how he was following in his father's footsteps. He wondered if Evans was doing the same. In response, Calvin wrote back in all caps saying that he hated his father and hoped he was dead. Wakeley was shocked. It was obvious that Evans had been badly hurt by his father, and knowing Evans, that his hatred had to be based in the most heartless thing of all, evidence. He'd started to write back to Evans several times, but couldn't figure out what to say. Him, the minister, the guy currently writing a theology thesis titled The Need for Consolation in Modern Society. No words. Their pen pal relationship ended. Just after graduation, his father died unexpectedly. He returned to Commons for the funeral and decided to stay. He found a small place by the beach, took over his father's congregation, got out his surfboard. He'd been there a few years when he finally learned that Evans was also in Commons. He couldn't believe it. What were the odds? But before he could get up the nerve to reconnect with his famous friend, Evans was killed in a freak accident. The word went out. Someone was needed to officiate the scientist's funeral. Wakeley volunteered. He felt compelled to pay his respects to one of the few people he admired, to help in whatever way he could to guide Evans' spirit to a place of peace. Plus, he was curious. Who would be there? Who would grieve the loss of this brilliant man? The answer? A woman and a dog. In case it helps, Madeline added, tell them my dad was a rower. Wakeley paused, remembering the extra-long casket. He tried to reconstruct exactly what he'd said to the young woman who stood by the graveside. I'm sorry for your loss, probably. He'd planned to speak with her after the service, but before he'd even finished the closing prayer, she'd walked away, the dog at her heels. He told himself he'd go see her, but he didn't know her name or where she lived, and while it wouldn't have been that difficult to find out, he didn't pursue it. There was something about her that made him feel talking about Evan's soul might just make matters worse. After the service, for months after, he couldn't get the brevity of Evan's life out of his head. There were so few people who actually did things in the world that mattered, who made discoveries that changed things. Evans had slipped between the cracks of the unknown and explored the universe in a way that theology completely avoided, and for a very short period of time, he felt like he'd been part of it. Still, that was then, and this was now. He was a minister. He didn't need science. What he did need were more inventive ways to tell his flock to act like decent people, to stop being so mean to one another, to behave. So, in the end, despite his doubts, he became a reverend. But he continued to think of the remarkable Evans, and now, here was this little girl claiming to be his daughter. God really did move in mysterious ways. Just to be clear, he said, we're talking about Calvin Evans, the one who was killed in a car accident about 5 years ago. It was a leash, but yes. Ah, he said, but here's the tricky part. Calvin Evans didn't have children. In fact, he wasn't, he hesitated. What? Nothing, he said quickly. Obviously, the little girl was illegitimate on top of everything else. And what's that there? He asked, pointing to a yellowed newspaper clipping sticking out from her notebook. More of the assignment? I have to bring in a family photo, she said, retrieving a clipping still damp with dog saliva. She held it out gingerly, the way one might an irreplaceable treasure. It's the only one we're all in. He unfolded it carefully. It was an article about Calvin Evans's funeral, and in it was a photograph of the same woman and the dog, their backs to the camera, but their devastation clear, watching as the earth swallowed the very casket he had blessed. A wave of depression swept over him. But Mad, how in the world is this a family picture? Well, that's my mom, Madeline said, pointing to Elizabeth's back. And 6:30, she said, pointing at the dog. And I'm inside my mom, just there, she said, pointing at Elizabeth again. And my dad is in the box. Wakeley had spent the last 7 years of his life consoling people. But there was something about the way this child spoke so matter-of-factly about her loss that depleted him. Mad, I need you to understand something, he said, noting with shock that his own hands were in the photograph. Families aren't meant to fit on trees. Maybe because people aren't part of the plant kingdom, we're part of the animal kingdom.
Exactly, Madeline gasped. That's exactly what I was trying to tell Mrs. Mudford.
If we were trees, he added, worrying about how much grief this child was going to endure explaining her origins, we might be a bit wiser. Long life and all that. And then he realized Calvin Evans hadn't had a very long life, and he just implied that it was probably because Evans hadn't been very smart. Honestly, he was a terrible minister, the worst. Madeline seemed to consider this answer, then leaned way across the table.
Wakely, she said in a low voice, I have to go watch my mom now, but I was wondering, can you keep a secret?
I can, he said, wondering what she meant by watching her mom. Was her mom sick? She looked at him closely as if trying to determine if he was lying again, then got up from her chair and went to his side and whispered something so vigorously in his ear, his eyes grew wide in wonder. Before he could stop himself, he cupped his hand around her ear and did the same thing. Then they both leaned away from each other in surprise.
That's not so bad, Wakely, Madeline said. Really?
But about hers, he couldn't find the words. Chapter 29 Bonding. My name is Elizabeth Zott, and this is Supper at Six. Hands on her hips, her lips outlined in brick red, her thick hair pulled back into a simple French twist secured with a number two pencil, Elizabeth leveled her gaze and looked directly into the camera. Exciting news, she said. Today we're going to study three different types of chemical bonds, ionic, covalent, and hydrogen. Why learn about bonds? Because when you do, you will grasp the very foundation of life, plus your cakes will rise. From homes all over Southern California, women pulled out paper and pencils. Ionic is the opposites attract chemical bond, Elizabeth explained as she emerged from behind the counter and began to sketch on an easel. For instance, let's say you wrote your PhD thesis on free market economics, but your husband rotates tires for a living. You love each other, but he's probably not interested in hearing about the invisible hand, and who can blame him, because you know the invisible hand is libertarian garbage. She looked out at the audience as various people scribbled notes, several of which read, invisible hand, libertarian garbage. The point is, you and your husband are completely different, and yet you still have a strong connection. That's fine. It's also ionic. She paused, lifting the sheet of paper over the top of the easel to reveal a fresh page of newsprint. Or, perhaps your marriage is more of a covalent bond, she said, sketching a new structural formula. And if so, lucky you, because that means you both have strengths that, when combined, create something even better. For example, when hydrogen and oxygen combine, what do we get? Water, or H2O, as it's more commonly known. In many respects, the covalent bond is not unlike a party, one that's made better thanks to the pie you made and the wine he brought. Unless you don't like parties, I don't, in which case you could also think of the covalent bond as a small European country, say Switzerland. Alps, she quickly wrote on the easel. Plus, a strong economy equals everybody wants to live there. In a living room in La Jolla, California, three children fought over a toy dump truck, its broken axle lying directly adjacent to a skyscraper of ironing that threatened to topple a small woman, her hair in curlers, a small pad of paper in her hands. Switzerland, she wrote. Move. That brings us to the third bond, Elizabeth said, pointing at another set of molecules, the hydrogen bond, the most fragile, delicate bond of all. I call this the love-at-first-sight bond, because both parties are drawn to each other based solely on visual information. You like his smile, he likes your hair, but then you talk and discover he's a closet Nazi and thinks women complain too much. Poof! Just like that, the delicate bond is broken. That's the hydrogen bond for you, ladies, a chemical reminder that if things seem too good to be true, they probably are. She walked back behind the counter and, exchanging the marker for a knife, took a Paul Bunyan swing at a large yellow onion, cleaving it in two. It's chicken pot pie night, she announced. Let's get started. See? A woman in Santa Monica demanded as she turned to her sullen 17-year-old daughter, The girl's eyeliner so thick it looked as if planes could land there.
What did I tell you? Your bond with that boy is hydrogen only. When are you going to wake up and smell the ions?
Not this again.
You could go to college. You could be something. He loves me. He's holding you back.
More after this, Elizabeth said as the cameraman indicated a commercial break. From his producer's chair, Walter Pine slumped. After a massive amount of groveling, he'd managed to get Phil Lebensmal to extend Zott's contract for another 6 months, but only by agreeing that sexy was in, science was out. The clock, Phil had warned, was really ticking this time. According to him, they'd been getting a lot of complaints. Walter broached the subject with Elizabeth just before the show.
We have to make a few changes, he explained.
She'd listened, nodding her head thoughtfully as if considering each change carefully.
No, she said.
In addition to that little problem, Amanda had some stupid family tree assignment that demanded a current family photograph with Mommy, even though Mommy was long out of the picture. Worse, it insisted on celebrating the biological relationship between himself and his child, a bond that did not exist and never would. Obviously, he was planning on telling Amanda the truth, and soon, that her lousy mother was never coming back and that technically he and she weren't related in any way. Adopted children had the right to know. He was waiting for the right moment, her 40th birthday.
Walter, Elizabeth said as she strode toward him, have you heard from your insurance people?
As you know, tomorrow's show focuses on combustion, and while I continue to believe there's really no significant danger, I...
Walter? She waved her hand in front of his face. Walter?
60 seconds, Zott, said the cameraman.
It wouldn't hurt to have a couple of extra fire extinguishers on hand. Again, I'd prefer the nitrogen propellant over the newer water and foam models, but that's just me. I'm sure either one will do the job.
Walter, are you listening?
Respond, she frowned, then turned back to the stage. I'll catch you next break. As she made her way back up on stage, Walter turned to watch her mount the steps. Her blue trousers, she was wearing trousers, belted high on the waist. Who did she think she was, Katharine Hepburn? Lebensmal would go ballistic. He turned, motioning for the makeup woman.
Yes, Mr. Pine, said Rosa, her hands full of small sponges. Did you need something?
Zod's face was fine, by the way. She wasn't glistening. He sighed. She never glistens, he said. Despite the fact that those lights alone would sear a steak in 30 seconds, she never breaks a sweat. How is that possible?
It is unusual, Rosa agreed.
And we're back, he heard Elizabeth say as she pointed both hands at the camera.
Please be normal, whispered Walter.
Now, Elizabeth said to her at-home viewers, I am confident you used our short break to chop your carrots, celery, and onions into small, disparate units, thereby creating the necessary surface area to facilitate the uptake of seasoning, as well as to shorten cooking time. So, now things look like this, she said, tipping a pan at the camera. Next, apply a liberal amount of sodium chloride.
Would it kill her to say salt? Walter hissed. Would it?
I like how she uses sciencey words, Rosa said. It makes me feel, I don't know, capable.
Capable? He said.
Capable? What happened to wanting to feel slim and beautiful? And what the hell is going on with those trousers? Where did those come from?
Are you okay, Mr. Pine? Rosa asked. Can I get you something?
Yes, he said. Cyanide. Several more minutes passed as Elizabeth led viewers through the chemical makeup of various other ingredients, explaining as she added each to the pan which bonds were being created.
There, she said, tipping the pan to the camera again. What do we have now?
A mixture which is a combination of two or more pure substances in which each substance retains its individual chemical properties. In the case of our chicken pot pie, notice how your carrots, peas, onions, and celery are mixed yet remain separate entities. Think about that. A successful chicken pot pie is like a society that functions at a highly efficient level. Call it Sweden. Here, every vegetable has its place. No single bit of produce demands to be more important than another. And when you throw in the additional spices, garlic, thyme, pepper, and sodium chloride, you've created a flavor that not only enhances each substance's texture, but balances the acidity. Result? Subsidized childcare. Although I'm sure Sweden has its problems too. Skin cancer, at the very least. She took a cue from the cameraman. We'll be right back after this station identification.
What was that? Walter gasped. What did she say?
Subsidized childcare, Rosa said as she sponged his forehead. We should get that on the ballot. She leaned down, taking in a vein pulsing on Walter's forehead.
Listen, why don't I go get you some acetyl salicylic acid? It'll...
What did you say? He hissed, batting her sponge away.
Subsidized childcare.
No, the other...
Acetyl salicylic acid?
Aspirin, he demanded hoarsely. Here at KCTV, we call it aspirin. Bayer aspirin. Want to know why? Because Bayer is one of our sponsors, the people who pay our bills. Ring any bells? Say it. Aspirin.
Aspirin, she said.
Back in a flash.
Walter, Elizabeth's voice came abruptly from above, causing him to jump.
Jesus, Elizabeth, he said. Must you sneak up on me?
I wasn't sneaking. Your eyes were closed.
I was thinking.
About the fire extinguishers? So was I. Let's say three. Two will be sufficient, but three should almost completely eradicate any possibility of tragedy, up to or slightly beyond 99%.
My God, he shuddered to himself as he wiped his damp palms on his pants.
Is this a nightmare? Why can't I wake up?
You're wondering about the other 1%, Elizabeth said.
Well, don't. That tiny amount is mostly act of God stuff, earthquakes, tsunamis, things we can't possibly anticipate because the science isn't there yet.
She paused, straightening her belt.
Walter, don't you find it interesting that people even use that term, act of God, considering that most want to believe that God is about lambs and love and babies and mangers, and yet this same so-called benevolent being smites innocent people left and right, indicating an anger management problem, maybe even manic depression. In a psychiatric ward, such a patient would be subjected to electroshock therapy, which I don't favor. Electroshock therapy is still largely unproven. But isn't it interesting that acts of God and electroshock therapy share so much in common, in terms of being violent, cruel,
60 seconds, Zot,
unforgiving, barbarous?
Jesus, Elizabeth, please.
Anyway, let's say three. Every woman should know how to put out a fire. We'll start with the smothering technique, then when that fails, go to nitrogen.
40 seconds, Zot.
And what is with the trousers, Walter said, his teeth clenched so tightly the words barely emerged.
What do you mean?
You know what I mean. Do you like them? You must. You wear them all the time. And I can see why they're very comfortable. Don't worry, I plan to give you full credit.
No, Elizabeth, I never...
Here's your aspirin, Mr. Pine, Rosa interrupted, appearing at his side. And Zot, let me take a quick look at your... Good, good. Turn your face the other way now. Good. Amazing, really. Okay, you're all set.
Zot, in 10, called the cameraman.
Are you sick, Walter?
Have you seen the Family Tree Project? He whispered.
8 seconds, Zot.
You look pale, Walter.
The tree, he barely eked out.
Free? But I thought you said I couldn't give things away anymore.
Elizabeth climbed back up on stage and, turning to the camera, said,
And we're back.
I don't know what you think you gave me, Walter snapped at Rosa, but it's not working.
It takes time.
Which I don't have, he said. Give me the bottle.
You've already taken the max.
Oh, really? He snapped, shaking the bottle. Then explain why there are still some in here.
Now pour your version of Sweden, Elizabeth was saying, into the starch, lipid, and protein molecule configuration you rolled out earlier, your pie crust, the one whose chemical bonds were enabled using the water molecule H2O and through which you created the perfect marriage of stability and structure.
She paused, her now floured hands pointing at a pie crust filled with vegetables and chicken.
Stability and structure, she repeated, looking out at the studio audience. Chemistry is inseparable from life. By its very definition, chemistry is life. But like your pie, life requires a strong base. In your home, you are that base. It is an enormous responsibility, the most undervalued job in the world that nonetheless holds everything together.
Several women in the studio audience nodded vigorously.
Take a moment now to admire your experiment, Elizabeth continued. You've used the elegance of chemical bonding to construct a crust that will both house and enhance the flavor of your constituents. Consider your filling one more time. Then ask yourself, what does Sweden want? Citric acid? Maybe. Sodium chloride? Probably. Adjust. When you're satisfied, lay your second crust on top like a blanket, crimping the edges to create a seal. Then make a few short slashes across the top, creating a vent. The purpose of the vent is to give the water molecule the space it needs to convert to steam and escape. Without that vent, your pie is Mount Vesuvius. To protect your villagers from certain death, always slash. She picked up a knife and made three short slits on top. There, she said. Now pop it in your oven at 375 degrees Fahrenheit. Bake for approximately 45 minutes. She looked up at the clock. It looks like we have a little extra time, she said. Perhaps I could take a question from the studio audience? She looked at the cameraman who held a finger up to his throat as if to slit it.
No, 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 he mouthed.
Hello, she said, pointing at a woman in the front row, her glasses perched atop a stiff hairdo, her thick legs swathed in support hose.
I'm Mrs. George Phyllis from Kernville, the woman said nervously as she stood up, and I'm 38 years old. I just wanted to say how much I enjoy your show. I can't believe how much I've learned. I know I'm not the brightest bulb, she said, her face pink with shame.
Well, that's what my husband always says. And yet, last week, when you said osmosis was the movement of a less concentrated solvent through a semi-permeable membrane to another more concentrated solvent, I found myself wondering if...
Well, go on.
Well, if my leg edema might not be a byproduct of faulty hydraulic conductivity combined with an irregular osmotic reflection coefficient of plasma proteins, what do you think?
A very detailed diagnosis, Mrs. Phyllis, Elizabeth said.
What kind of medicine do you practice?
Oh, the woman stumbled. No, I'm not a doctor. I'm just a housewife.
There isn't a woman in the world who is just a housewife, Elizabeth said. What else do you do?
Nothing. A few hobbies. I like to read medical journals.
Interesting. What else?
Sewing.
Clothes.
Bodies.
Wound closures. Yes, I have five boys. They're always tearing holes in themselves.
And when you were their age, you envisioned yourself becoming a loving wife and mother.
No, seriously. An open-heart surgeon, the woman said before she could stop herself. The room filled with a thick silence, the weight of her ridiculous dream hanging like two wet laundry on a windless day. Open-heart surgery. For a moment, it seemed as if the entire world was waiting for the laughter that should follow. But then from one end of the audience came a single unexpected clap, immediately followed by another, and then 10 more, and then 20 more. And soon everyone in the audience was on their feet, and someone called out, "Dr. Phyllis, heart surgeon," and the clapping became thunderous.
No, no, the woman insisted above the noise. I was only kidding. I can't actually do that. Anyway, it's too late.
It's never too late, Elizabeth insisted.
But I couldn't, can't.
Why?
Because it's hard.
And raising five boys isn't? The woman touched her fingertips to the small beads of sweat dotting her forehead.
But where would someone like me even start?
The public library, Elizabeth said, followed by the MCAT school and residency. The woman suddenly seemed to realize that Elizabeth took her seriously.
You really think I could do it? She said, her voice trembling.
What's the molecular weight of barium chloride?
208.23. You'll be fine.
But my husband is a lucky man. By the way, it's free day, Mrs. Phyllis, Elizabeth said. Something my producer just invented. To show our support for your fearless future, you'll be taking home my chicken pot pie. Come on up and get it.
Amid roaring applause, Elizabeth handed the now determined-looking Mrs. Phyllis the foil-covered pie.
We're officially out of time, Elizabeth said, but I hope you'll tune in tomorrow as we explore the world of kitchen conflagrations. Then she looked right through the camera lens and almost as if she divined it, directly into the astonished faces of Mrs. George Phyllis's five children sprawled in front of the TV in Kernville, their eyes open wide, their mouths agape, as if they had just seen their mother for the very first time.
Boys, set the table, Elizabeth commanded. Your mother needs a moment to herself.
Chapter 30. 99%. Mad? Elizabeth began carefully a week later. Mrs. Mudford called me at work today, Something about an inappropriate family photo? Madeline took a sudden interest in a scab on her knee. And attached to this photo was a family tree, Elizabeth said gently, in which you claim to be a direct descendant of, she paused, consulting a list, Nefertiti, Sojourner Truth, and Amelia Earhart. Does that sound familiar? Madeline looked up innocently. Not really. And the tree includes an acorn labeled Fairy Godmother.
Huh.
And at the bottom, someone wrote, Humans are animals. That was underlined 3 times, and then it says, Inside humans are genetically 99% the same. Madeline looked up at the ceiling. 99%? Elizabeth said. What? Madeline said. Well, that's inaccurate. But in science, accuracy matters. But the fact is, it can be as high as 99.9%. 99.9. Then she stopped and wrapped her arms around her daughter. It's my fault, sweetheart. With the exception of pi, we really haven't covered decimals yet. Sorry to intrude, Harriet called as she let herself in the back door. Phone messages, forgot to leave them. She plunked a list down in front of Elizabeth and turned to go. Harriet, Elizabeth said, scanning the list. Who's this one? The Reverend from First Presbyterian? Madeline's hair rose on her arms. It sounded like one of those church drum-up-the-business calls. He asked for Mad, probably working from a bad list. Anyway, this is the one I wanted to make sure you saw, she said, tapping the list. The L.A. Times. They've been calling at work, too, Elizabeth said. They want an interview. An interview? You're going to be in the newspaper again? Mad said, worried. Her family had been in the newspaper twice, once when her father died, and once when her father's gravestone was blown to bits by a stray bullet. Not a great track record. No, Mad, Elizabeth said. The person who wants to interview me isn't even a science reporter. He writes for the women's page. He's already told me he has no interest in talking about chemistry, just dinner. Clearly he doesn't understand you can't separate the two, and I suspect he also wants to ask questions about our family, even though our family is none of his business. Why not? Madeline asked. What's wrong with our family? From under the table, 630 lifted his head. He hated that Mad thought there might be something wrong with her family. As for Nefertiti and the others, it wasn't just Mad's wishful thinking. It was accurate in one critical sense. All humans shared a common ancestor. How could Mudford not know this? He was a dog, and even he knew this. By the way, in case anyone was interested, he just learned a new word. Diary. It was a place where one wrote vicious things about one's family and friends and hoped to God they never saw. With diary, his word count was now up to 648. See you both in the morning, Harriet called, slamming the door behind her. What's wrong with our family, Mom? Madeline repeated. Nothing, Elizabeth said sharply, clearing the table. 630, help me with the fume hood. I want to try cleaning the dishes using a hydrocarbon vapor. Tell me about Dad. I've told you everything, sweetheart, she said, her face suddenly lit with affection. He was a brilliant, honest, loving man, a great rower and a gifted chemist. He was tall and gray-eyed like you, and he had very large hands. His parents died in an unfortunate collision with a train, and his aunt hit a tree. He went to live in a boy's home where... She paused, her blue and white checked dress swaying at her calves as she reconsidered her dishwashing experiment. Do me a favor, Mad, and put on this oxygen mask. And 630, let me help you with your goggles. There. She said, adjusting everyone's straps. Anyway, then your father went on to Cambridge, where he...
I home,
Mad attempted through the mask. We've been over this, honey. I don't know much about the boys' home. Your father didn't like to talk about it. It was private.
Private? Private? Or hate her?
She attempted through the mask. Private, her mother said firmly. Sometimes bad things happen. This is a fact of life. In terms of the boys' home, your father did not talk about it because I suspect he knew dwelling on it would not change it. He was raised without a family, without parents he could count on, without the protection and love every child is entitled to. But he persevered. Often the best way to deal with the bad, she said, feeling for her pencil, is to turn it on end, use it as a strength, refuse to allow the bad thing to define you, fight it. The way she said it, like a warrior, made Madeline worry. Have bad things happened to you too, Mom? She tried to ask. Besides Dad dying? But the dish cleaning experiment was in full swing, and her question was lost in the cocoon of the mask and the ringing of the phone.
Yes, Walter, Elizabeth said a moment later. I hope I'm not disturbing anything.
Not at all, she said, despite an unusual humming in the background. How can I help?
Well, I was calling about two things. The first is the family tree assignment. I was just wondering.
Yes, she confirmed, we're in trouble.
Us too, he said miserably. She seemed to know the names I put on the branches were complete fabrications. Is that what you did too?
No, Elizabeth said. Mad made a math error.
He paused, not understanding. I have to see Mudford tomorrow, she continued. By the way, I wasn't sure if you'd heard, but both girls have been assigned to her classroom again in the fall. She's teaching first grade, and when I say teaching, of course, I'm being ironic. I've already registered a complaint.
Lord, Walter sighed. What's the second thing, Walter?
It's Phil, he said. He's not happy.
Well, nor am I, Elizabeth said. How did he ever become executive producer? He lacks vision, leadership, and manners, and the way he treats the women at the station is contemptible.
Well, Walter said, thinking how, when discussing Elizabeth a few weeks back, Lebensmal had actually spat at him. I agree that he can be a bit of a character.
That's not character, Walter. That's degradation. I'm going to register a complaint with the board.
Walter shook his head. Again with the complaints.
Elizabeth, Phil's on the board.
Well, someone needs to be made aware of his behavior.
Surely, Walter said with a sigh, surely you know by now that the world is filled with Phils. Our best bet is to try and get along, make the best of a bad situation. Why can't you just do that?
She tried to think of a good reason to make the best of Phil Lebensmal.
No, she couldn't come up with a single thing.
Look, I have an idea, he continued. Phil's been courting a new potential sponsor, a soup manufacturer. He wants you to use the soup on your show, like in a casserole. Do that, attract a big sponsor, and I think he'll cut us some slack.
A soup manufacturer? I only work with fresh ingredients.
Can you at least try to meet me halfway, he begged. It's one can of soup. Think of the others, all the people who work on your show. We all have families to feed, Elizabeth. We all need to keep our jobs.
From her end of the phone came silence, as if she were weighing his words.
I'd like to meet with Phil face to face, she said. Clear the air.
No, Walter emphasized. Not that, never that.
She exhaled sharply.
Fine. Today is Monday. Bring McCann in on Thursday. I'll see what I can do.
But the week steadily got worse. The next day, Tuesday, Mudford's tree assignment revelations were the talk of the school. Madeline had been born out of wedlock. Amanda didn't have a mother. Tommy Dixon's father was an alcoholic. Not that any of the children themselves cared about these facts, but Mudford, her mean eyes wet with excitement, ate up the data like a hungry virus, then fed it to the other mothers who spread it around school like frosting. On Wednesday, someone surreptitiously shoved a sheet of paper listing the compensation of every KCTV employee under Elizabeth's door. Elizabeth stared at the figures. She made a third of what the sports guy did, a guy who was on the air less than 3 minutes a day and whose only skill involved reading scores. Worse, apparently there was something called profit sharing at KCTV, but only the male employees had been invited to take part. But it was the way Harriet looked when she arrived on Thursday morning that made Elizabeth rage. She'd just finished tucking a note into Madeline's lunchbox. Matter can neither be created nor destroyed, but it can be rearranged. In other words, don't sit next to Tommy Dixon. When Harriet sat down at the table, and despite the darkness of the morning, did not remove her sunglasses.
Harriet? Elizabeth said, instantly alarmed.
In a voice that was trying very hard to make it seem like it was no big deal, Harriet explained that Mr. Sloan had been out of sorts last night. She'd tossed some of his girly magazines, the Dodgers had lost. He didn't approve of the way Elizabeth encouraged that woman to be a heart surgeon. He winged an empty beer bottle at her, and she'd fallen back like a target at a shooting range.
I'm calling the police, Elizabeth said, reaching for the phone.
No, Harriet said, resting her hand on Elizabeth's arm. They won't do anything, and I refuse to give him that satisfaction.
Besides, I belted him with my purse. I'm going over there right now, Elizabeth said. He needs to understand this sort of behavior will not be tolerated. She stood up. I'll get my baseball bat. No, if you attack him, the police will be all over you, not him. Elizabeth thought about this. Harriet was right. Her jaw tensed, and she felt the too familiar rage from her own police encounter years ago. No statement of regret, then. She reached back and felt for her pencil. I can take care of myself. He doesn't scare me, Elizabeth. He disgusts me. There's a difference. Elizabeth knew this feeling exactly. She bent down and put her arms around Harriet. Despite their friendship, the two women rarely touched. There's nothing I wouldn't do for you, Elizabeth said, pulling her close. You know that, don't you? Harriet, surprised, looked up at Elizabeth, tears forming. Well, me too. Ditto. Then the older woman finally pulled away. It'll be okay, Harriet promised, wiping her face. Just let it go. But Elizabeth was not the type of person who let things go. When she pulled out of the driveway 5 minutes later, she'd already formulated a plan. Hello, viewers, Elizabeth said 3 hours later, and welcome back. See this? She held a soup can close to the camera. It's a real time saver. From his producer's chair, Walter gasped in gratitude. She was using the soup. That's because it's full of chemicals, she said, tossing it with a clunk into a nearby garbage can. Feed enough of it to your loved ones, and they'll eventually die off, saving you tons of time since you won't have to feed them anymore. The cameraman turned to look at Walter, confused. Walter glanced down at his watch as if he'd forgotten an important appointment, then got up and walked out, making his way directly to the parking lot, where he got in his car and drove home. Luckily, there are much faster ways to kill off your loved ones, she continued, walking to her easel, where a selection of mushroom drawings was on display. And mushrooms are an excellent place to start. If it were me, I'd opt for Amanita phalloides, she said, tapping one of the drawings, also known as the death cap mushroom. Not only does its poison withstand high heat, making it a go-to ingredient for a benign-looking casserole, but it very much resembles its non-toxic cousin, the straw mushroom. So if someone dies and there is an inquiry, you can easily play the dumb housewife and plead mistaken mushroom identity. Phil Levensmall looked up from his desk at one of the screens in his TV-littered office. What did she just say? The great thing about poisonous mushrooms, she continued, is how easily they adapt to different forms. If not a casserole, why not try a stuffed mushroom, something you can share with your next-door neighbor, the one who goes out of his way to make life miserable for his wife? He's already got one foot in the grave. Why not help him with the other? At this, someone in the audience let out a whoop of unexpected laughter and a clap. Meanwhile, the camera also managed to capture several pairs of hands carefully writing down the words Amanita phalloides. Of course, I'm only kidding about poisoning your loved ones, Elizabeth said. I'm sure your husbands and children are all wonderful human beings who always go out of their way to tell you how much they appreciate your hard work, or in the unlikely event that you work outside the home, that your fair-minded boss ensures you're paid the same wage as your male counterpart. This also got even more laughs and claps, all of which followed her as she walked back behind the counter. It's broccoli mushroom casserole tonight, she said, holding up a basket of maybe straw mushrooms? Let's get started. It's fair to say no one in California touched their dinners that night. Zot, Rosa the makeup woman said on her way out, Levensmall wants to see you at 7. 7? Elizabeth blanched. Obviously the man has no children. By the way, have you seen Walter? I think he's mad at me. He left early, Rosa said. Look, I don't think you should go see Levensmall by yourself. I'll come with you.
I'm fine, Rosa.
Maybe you should call Walter first. He never lets any of us meet with Levensmall alone.
I know, Elizabeth said. Don't worry.
Rosa hesitated, looking at the clock.
Go home. It's not a big deal.
At least call Walter first, Rosa said. Let him know. She turned to gather her things. By the way, I loved tonight's show. It was funny. Elizabeth looked up, her eyebrows raised.
Funny?
A few minutes before 7, after finishing her notes for tomorrow's show, Elizabeth hefted her large bag to her shoulder and walked the empty hallways of KCTV to Levensmall's office. She knocked twice, then let herself in.
You wanted to see me, Phil? Lebensmal was sitting behind an enormous desk covered with stacks of papers and half-eaten food, four huge televisions broadcasting loud reruns in a ghostly black and white, the air stale with cigarette smoke. One set was airing a soap opera, another Jack LaLanne, still another a kids' program, and the fourth, Supper at Six. She'd never watched her own show before, never once experienced the sound of her own voice coming through a speaker. It was horrible.
"It's about time," Lebensmal said irritably as he stubbed a cigarette into a decorative cut glass bowl. He pointed to a chair indicating that Elizabeth should sit, then huffed to the door and slammed it shut, pressing the lock button.
"I was told 7, she said.
"Did I tell you to speak?" he snapped.
From the left, she heard herself explain the interaction of heat and fructose. She cocked her head toward the set. Had she gotten the pH right?
Yes, she had. "Do you know who I am?" he demanded from across the room, but the blaring TVs muddled his words.
"Do I know about yams?"
"I said," he spoke louder this time as he returned to his desk, "do you know who I am?"
"You are Phil Lebensmal," Elizabeth said loudly. "Would you mind if I turn the TVs off? It's hard to hear."
"Don't sass me," he said. "When I say do you know who I am, I mean do you know who I am?"
For a moment, she looked confused. "Again, you are Phil Lebensmal, but if you like, we could double-check your driver's license." His eyes narrowed.
"Waistbands," shouted Jack LaLanne.
"Dance party," laughed a clown. "I never loved you," confessed a nurse.
"Acidic pH levels," she heard herself say.
"I am Mr. Lebensmal, executive producer of..."
"I'm sorry, Phil," she said, gesturing at the television speaker closest to her, "but I really can't..." She reached for the volume control.
"Do not," he boomed, "touch my televisions."
He rose, picking up a stack of file folders, and marched across the room, planting himself in front of her, his legs spread wide like a tripod. "You know what these are?" he said, wagging the folders in her face.
"File folders. Don't get smart with me. They're Supper at Six audience viewer questionnaires, ad sales figures, Nielsen ratings."
"Really?" she said. "I'd love to take..." But before she could take a look, he snatched them away.
"As if you'd even know how to interpret the findings," he said sharply. "As if you have any idea what any of this means."
He slapped the folders against his thigh, then strode back to his desk.
"I've let this nonsense go on far too long. Walter has failed to rein you in, but I won't. If you want to keep your job, you will wear what I choose, mix the cocktails I want, and make the dinner using normal words. You will also..."
He stopped in mid-sentence, put off by her reaction, or rather, non-reaction. It was the way she sat in her chair, like a parent waiting for a child to finish his tantrum.
"On second thought," he spat impulsively, "you're fired."
And when she still didn't react, he got up and stomped over to the four TVs and switched them all off, breaking two knobs in the process.
"Everyone is fired," he bellowed. "You, Pine, and anyone and everyone who has had even the smallest role in aiding and abetting your crap, you're all out."
Breathing hard, he went back to his desk and flung himself in his chair, awaiting the only two reactions from her that could or should inevitably follow, crying or apologies, preferably both. Elizabeth nodded in the now quiet room as she smoothed the front of her trousers. "You're firing me because of tonight's poison mushroom episode, as well as any other person associated with the show?"
"That's right," he emphasized, unable to hide his surprise that his threat had not impressed her. "Everyone's out, and it's because of you. Jobs lost, all because of you. Done."
He sat back and waited for her to grovel.
"So, to clarify," she said, "I'm being fired because I won't wear your clothes and smile into your camera, but also because, is this correct? I don't know who you are. And to further make your point, you're firing everyone associated with Supper at Six, even though these people also work on 4 or 5 other shows for which they'd suddenly be in absentia, meaning that those other shows will also be affected to the point where they will not be able to air."
Frustrated by her obvious logic, Phil tensed.
"I can have those positions filled in 24 hours, he said, snapping his fingers. "Less."
"And this is your final decision, despite the show's success?"
"Yes, it's my final decision," he said. "And no, the show is not a success. That's the point."
He picked up the folders again and waved them.
"Complaints pour in every day about you, your opinions, your science. Our sponsors are threatening to walk. That soup manufacturer, they'll probably sue us."
Sponsors? She said, tapping her fingertips together as if glad for the reminder. I've been meaning to speak with you about them. Acid reflux tablets, aspirin. Products like these seem to imply the show's dinners aren't going to sit well.
Because they don't, Phil shot back.
He'd already crunched more than 10 antacid tablets in the last 2 hours, and his insides were still in an uproar. As for the complaints, she acknowledged, we've had a few, but they're nothing compared to the letters of support, which I didn't expect. I have a history of not fitting in, Phil, but I'm starting to think that not fitting in is why the show works.
The show does not work, he insisted. It's a disaster.
What was happening here? Why did she keep talking as if she wasn't fired? Feeling like one doesn't fit is a horrible feeling, she continued, unruffled. Humans naturally want to belong. It's part of our biology. But our society makes us feel that we're never good enough to belong. Do you know what I mean, Phil? Because we measure ourselves against useless yardsticks of sex, race, religion, politics, schools, even height and weight.
What?
In contrast, Supper at Six focuses on our commonalities, our chemistries. So even though our viewers may find themselves locked into a learned societal behavior, say the old men are like this, women are like that type of thing, the show encourages them to think beyond that cultural simplicity, to think sensibly, like a scientist. Phil heaved back in his chair, unfamiliar with the sensation of losing. Well, that's why you want to fire me, because you want a show that reinforces societal norms, that limits an individual's capacity. I completely understand. Phil's temple began to throb, hands shaking. He reached for a pack of Marlboros, tapped one out, and lit it. For a moment, all was quiet as he inhaled deeply, the radiant end emitting the smallest crackle, like a doll's campfire. As he exhaled, he studied her face. He got up abruptly, his body vibrating with frustration, and strode over to a sideboard littered with important-looking amber whiskies and bourbons. Grabbing one, he tipped it into a thick-walled shot glass until the liquid hit the rim and threatened to spill over. He threw it down his throat and poured another, then turned to look at her.
There's a pecking order here, he said, and it's about time you learned how that works.
She looked back at him, nonplussed. I want to go on record saying that Walter Pine has been absolutely tireless in his efforts to get me to follow your suggestions. This is despite the fact that he, too, believes the show could and should be more. He shouldn't be punished for my actions. He's a good man, a loyal employee. At the mention of Walter, Leben Small set down his glass and took another drag of his cigarette. He didn't like anyone who questioned his authority, but he could not and would not tolerate a woman doing so. With his pinstripe suit jacket parted at the waist, he locked his eyes on her, then slowly started to undo his belt.
I probably should have done this from the very beginning, he said, snaking the belt from its loops. Establish the ground rules. But in your case, let's just consider this part of your exit interview.
Elizabeth pressed her forearms down on the armchair. In a steady voice, she said, I would advise you not to get any closer, Phil. He looked at her meanly.
You really don't seem to understand who's in charge here, do you? But you will.
Then he glanced down, successfully freeing the button and unzipping his pants. Removing himself, he stumbled over to her, his genitals bobbing limply just inches from her face. She shook her head in wonder. She had no idea why men believed women found male genitalia impressive or scary. She bent over to reach into her bag.
I know who I am, he shouted thickly, thrusting himself at her. The question is, who the hell do you think you are?
I am Elizabeth Zott, she said calmly, withdrawing a freshly sharpened 14-inch chef's knife. But she wasn't sure he'd heard. He'd fainted dead away. Chapter 31. The Get Well Card. It was a heart attack. Not a massive one, but in 1960, most people didn't survive even minor heart attacks. The man was lucky to be alive. The doctor said he'd remain hospitalized for 3 weeks, followed by complete home bed rest for at least a year. Work was out of the question.
You were the one who called the ambulance? Walter gasped. You were there?
It was the next day, and Walter had just heard the news. I was, Elizabeth said.
And he was, what, on the floor, clutching his heart, gasping?
Not exactly.
Well, then what?
Walter said, spreading his arms in frustration as Elizabeth and the makeup woman exchanged glances. What happened?
Why don't I come back later? Rosa said quickly as she packed up her case. Before she left, she gave Elizabeth's shoulder a small squeeze. Always an honor, Zot. An absolute honor.
Walter watched this whole interaction, his eyebrows raised in panic.
You saved Phil's life, he said nervously as the door clicked shut. I get that, but what happened exactly? Don't leave anything out. Start with why you were there in the first place, after 7 p.m. That makes no sense. Tell me, omit nothing.
Elizabeth swiveled her chair to face Walter. She reached for her number two pencil, removing it from her bun and securing it behind her left ear, then picked up her coffee cup and took a sip.
He asked for a meeting, she said. Said it couldn't wait.
A meeting? He said, horrified. But I've said, you know, we've talked about this. You are never to meet with Phil on your own. It's not that I don't think you can't handle yourself. It's just that I'm your producer, and I think it's always better if...
He took out a handkerchief and held it to his forehead.
Elizabeth, he said, dropping his voice. Between you and me, Phil Levensmull is not a good man. Do you know what I mean? He's not trustworthy. He has a way of dealing with problems that...
He fired me.
Walter blanched.
And you as well.
Jesus.
He fired everyone who works on the show.
No.
He said you failed to rein me in.
Walter turned an ashy gray. You have to understand, he said, clenching his handkerchief. You know how I feel about Phil. You know I don't agree with everything he says. Have I reined you in? Don't make me laugh. Have I forced you to wear those ridiculous outfits? Not once. Have I begged you to read the cheery cue cards? Well, yes, but only because I wrote them. He threw his hands up in the air. Look, Phil gave me 2 weeks. 2 weeks to find an appropriate way to make him see that your outrageous way of doing things actually works, that you get more fan mail, more calls, more people lining up for your studio audience than all of the other shows combined, and for those reasons alone, you should stay. But, you know, I can't just waltz in there and say, Phil, you're wrong and she's right. That's suicide. No, dealing with Phil means stroking his ego, using the angles, saying what he wants to hear. You know what I mean. When you held up that can of soup, I thought we'd cinched it, until you told everyone it was poison.
Because it is.
Look, Walter said, I live in the real world. And in that world, we say and do things in order to keep our stupid jobs. Do you have any idea how much crap I've endured in the last year? Plus, did you even know this? Our sponsors are about to walk.
Phil told you that?
Yes, and here's a newsflash. It doesn't matter how many warm and fuzzy letters you get, if the sponsors say, we hate Zot, that's it. And Phil's research says they hate you.
He shoved his handkerchief back in his pocket, then got up and filled a Dixie cup with water, awaiting the glug from the gallon jug, an unpleasant sound that always reminded him of his ulcer.
Look, he said, his hand on his abdomen, we should keep this between ourselves until I can figure something out. How many people know? Just you and me, right?
I told everyone on the show.
No.
I think it's safe to say the entire building knows by now.
No, he repeated, planting his palm to his forehead. Damn it, Elizabeth, what were you thinking? Don't you know how being fired works? Step one, never tell anyone the truth, claim you won the lottery, inherited a cattle ranch in Wyoming, got a huge offer in New York, that sort of thing. Step two, drink to excess until you figure out what to do. Jesus, it's like you're not familiar with TV's tribal ways.
Elizabeth took another sip of coffee.
Do you want to hear what happened or not?
There's more, he said anxiously.
What, he's going to repossess our cars too?
She looked at him straight on, her normally lineless forehead slightly furrowed, and just like that, his attention turned from himself to her. He felt uneasy. He'd completely overlooked the most critical component of her meeting with Phil. She'd met with him alone.
Tell me, he said, feeling as if he might vomit. Please tell me.
Were most men like Phil? In Walter's opinion, no. But did most men do anything about men like Phil, himself included? No. Sure, maybe that seemed shameful or cowardly, but honestly, what could anyone actually do? You didn't pick a fight with a man like Phil. To avoid these outcomes, you simply did what you were told. Everyone knew it, and everyone did it. But Elizabeth wasn't everyone.
He put a trembling hand to his forehead, hating every bone in his spineless body.
Did he try something? Did you have to fight him off? He whispered.
She sat up in her chair, the light of her makeup mirror providing an extra aura of fortitude. He studied her face with fear, thinking this was probably the same way Joan of Arc looked right before they lit the match.
He tried.
God, Walter shouted, crushing his Dixie cup in one hand. God, no.
Walter, relax. He failed.
Walter hesitated.
Because of the heart attack? He said, relieved.
Of course. What uncanny timing. The heart attack. Oh, thank the Lord. She looked at him quizzically, then reached down into her bag, the same bag she'd taken to Phil's office the previous night.
I wouldn't thank the Lord, she said, pulling that same 14-inch chef's knife out of her bag.
He gasped. Like most cooks, Elizabeth insisted on using her own knives. She brought them in each morning and took them home each evening. Everyone knew this. Everyone, except Phil.
I didn't touch him, she explained. He just keeled over.
Jesus, Walter whispered.
I called an ambulance, but you know how traffic is at that time of day. Took forever. So while I waited, I made good use of my time. Here, take a look.
She handed him the folders Leben Small had waved at her.
Syndication offers, she said as he registered obvious surprise at the contents. Did you know that we've been syndicated in the state of New York for the last 3 months? Also, some interesting new sponsorship offers. Despite what Phil told you, sponsors are falling all over themselves to be part of our show. Like this one, she said, tapping an ad for the RCA Victor Company.
Walter kept his eyes down.